as you look at the international scene. The untold story of 1993 was the extent to which countries, newly emerging democracies, countries in Asia and in Europe, see the importance of constructing the kind of electoral system, the kind of voting system that will give fair representation to all people.
How democracy is changing around the world on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Last time on Common Ground, we began our look at how most of the democracies in the world use voting systems quite different from that used in the United States and Canada. Most of the free world sends representatives to parliaments or congresses using some form of proportional representation. Proponents of proportional representation, or PR as it's called, say it results in a government that better reflects the actual needs, fears, and political divisions in the general public. Joining us to describe how this works around the world are two experts from the Center for Voting and Democracy. Rob Ritchie is national director, and former congressman and presidential candidate John Anderson is national chairman. First, Rob Ritchie tells us how a newly democratic Russia is using what's called a mixed member system, where half the seats in the National Assembly are filled by representatives from single member geographic districts, much like those used in the U.S., and the other half of the seats are divided among the political parties according to the percentage of the vote they receive in the popular election.
What they did in this last election in December was a mixed member system, half from single member districts, half from a party list. One difference they had in the German system, I don't know if we want to get too much into the details, but it's a rather important detail, is that they do their half separately. So you first do your district seats, and then there was about 225 proportional seats, and parties would win whatever proportion of those seats that their vote total meant. So like if you won 20%, then you'd win 20% of the 225. What they do in Germany and what they will do in New Zealand is actually use the party list seats to compensate for what happens in the single member district seats and make the whole parliament proportional to the party vote. So if some party does really well in the single member district seats, they might not get many people added on from the proportional seats. Anyway, Germany does that. Russia keeps them separate. At this point, it probably doesn't have that much of an impact because Russia has so many other things to consider for its democratic system. Like it has to develop political parties that have coherence, and there has to be a tradition of voters participating. Even though I think the voting system is the most important part of a democracy, it's not the only part. In Russia, they're just dealing with some basic issues. But I think it was important that they did a proportional system the way they did. Even though it's not an ideal situation right now, they do have a parliament that represents the diversity of opinion within the country. And so people aren't going to feel left out. And there is that extremist party led by Zhirinovsky in parliament, but he doesn't have a majority. And he probably can't win a majority in a proportional system, though I think he actually might be able to in a winner-take-all system, say in the Canada situation where you could happen to win with maybe only 30% of the vote, win a majority.
One of the stories in 1993 that really was not told in the U.S. press, although it was there to be reported, and it's pointed out in the first annual Voting and Democracy report that was put out by the Center for Voting and Democracy, was the rise of proportional representation in these new democracies, to the point where if you total up all of the countries that have now switched to some form of proportional representation, you have literally a half a billion people around the world who are conducting their elections on the basis of that kind of electoral system. And that, I believe, is significant for the future, and it ought to tell us something about efforts that could and should be made to reform our own voting system. As Rob has said, to encourage participation, to encourage people to believe that they're not frozen out of the system. And one of the objections has always been that, well, it will destabilize American politics. We will get these revolving door governments. Well, of course, that simply isn't so, because there's a very easy mechanism that can be employed to make sure that just a few noisy extremists don't end up with representation and disrupt the whole legislative process. You can have a threshold. You can provide, as they do in the German Republic, you can provide that you have to get 5% of the national vote in order to be represented in the national chamber, in the parliament or in the Congress. So if you have that threshold fail-safe mechanism, you can guarantee people representation without exposing them to the potential hazard of having just a few extremists, like Zhirinovsky, for example, although unfortunately he got more than any threshold that I would like to see in any PR system. But you can minimize the danger, the threat to the system that some people perceive to see or worry about, that you're just going to let anybody and everybody get elected.
Let's sort of continue our hopscotching of the globe here for proportional representation. In South Africa, the struggle for one man, one vote has gone on for so many years, and now it looks as if there's sort of the dawning of a realization, perhaps, that one man, one vote isn't enough, that isn't enough to ensure representation. Tell us what you think is going to happen in South Africa.
I think South Africa is a quite important country to talk about. One quick thing I wanted to point out is that we often use in our terminology man and he, and proportional systems point, one thing that they almost always do is provide for greater representation of women, and women actually make a majority of many democracies. But in the United States, for instance, there's only 10% of Congress that's women, and then you have some of these these new democracies that have never voted before. In their very first election, using a proportional system, you might have 15% women or 20%. In the Scandinavian PR democracies, it's close to 40. So that's an important aspect of PR, too, that it does, I think, promote looking at everyone in the population and sort of giving them a right to get the representation that they want. In South Africa, basically every major faction supports the principle of proportional representation, and it's actually right there in their new constitution that they adopted. And I think there are several reasons for that. For instance, the white government that's currently in office, the national government, was elected by a system of winner-take-all. And since they've held office, or they've run the South African government since the late 1940s, and they've done so in large part because of a winner-take-all system that made a majority of the vote, but that made that majority a much bigger majority in parliament because of the winner-take-all dynamics, so that the other parties in South Africa really wanted proportional representation, because they were being completely thwarted as minority parties. And now suddenly you have the franchise extended to the majority black population, and the National Party recognizes that it's now in the minority. And there's been actually some quite eloquent statements from President de Klerk saying, we don't want the new country system to do what we did, which was dominate things. So it clearly was in their self-interest to have a proportional system. But I think what's probably most impressive is that the African National Congress, which at this point polls show has a more than 50% support, could probably completely dominate a winner-take-all system election, strongly supported proportional representation, because they said, we don't want to dominate the way that we've been dominated. And that I think that they recognize for a long-term stability in a society, and particularly a very explosive one like South Africa, that you want to have all sides at the table. And they've actually gone further and said that they actually want some of these representatives of smaller parties to have a voice in the cabinet, and not just a voice in the legislature, but a voice in some of the governing functions. We'll have to see what happens there. It's such a dramatic change that the voting system won't be the answer to all their problems. But they went through an elaborate process of trying to figure out what to do, and they came up with a party-less form of proportional representation. And I think that that, I hope, sets a lesson for many other emerging democracies that have been very conflict-torn. And I think Cambodia is another example where they used a semi-proportional system that basically provided pretty proportional results, and that helped that country make a transition to democracy that so far hasn't broken down. You know, it's been about a year since their elections. So I think this is a key issue for the young democracies in the world, too.
Before we go on to I want to ask you about Japan in a second. I want to make sure that I understand, that our listeners understand, the mechanism here for party list voting. Let's say there are 200 seats in the given body, and so Party X would publish a list of 200 candidates, and if they received 50% of the vote, the top 100 names on that list would go
exactly
into that parliament.
And that's what's the closed list system, where you can't exchange any. You can't change the order of the list. There are these open list systems in which voters, and this is actually true of most countries in Europe, they have some ability to raise people up on the list. But I think there's some strong arguments for a closed list, actually. I mean, a party will probably put forward the people that it thinks people will want to vote for. So I think there are arguments on both sides. But anyway, South Africa did go for the closed list system. Their parties are actually just now announcing their lists, and it's sort of interesting to see what they stand for. It really is a good way to now measure, well, what does the ANC stand for? Well, here's actually the top 100 people on their list, the ones that for sure will win office, and now we know what they stand for, and now we can decide if we really want to vote for them. So in some ways, it results in greater accountability, I think, too.
All right. Well, Mr. Ritchie, let's go on and talk about what's happening in Japan. The new reforms were proposed. We have a new prime minister sort of sweeping away some old cobwebs in the Japanese system, yet there's been a setback in the reform process. What's happening in Japan? What kind of system have they used, and what are they proposing to use?
Japan has for decades used a system that's called the single non-transferable vote, or what some political scientists would call limited voting. They will have constituencies in which that are represented by 3, 4, or 5 people, and voters have one vote, and then the top 3 or 4 or 5 people win. What that means is that, say, if some party has a majority in that constituency, they won't win all 3 seats. They won't win all 4. They'll probably win a majority of that, but not all of them. And that's resulted in diversity within their parliament, though at the same time, this last election in 1993 was the first time that the Liberal Democrats hadn't won. So what they have now is a semi-proportional system, one that is quite likely to result in the majority party maintaining a majority, because often the smaller parties don't even run enough candidates to win a majority, because they're just trying to win their one seat, say, in a 5-member constituency. There's some other problems with their system as well. One is campaign finance reform is desperately needed, but also they don't have fair apportionment, so that some of the rural constituencies have 3 representatives for a population that might only be half the size of another 3-member constituency in a city, so that it's not really a one-person, one-vote system in the way that we have very strong laws requiring that. The reform was to go to a mixed system, like the Russian system, actually, almost exactly like it. It would have been 276 single-member district seats, 224 party list seats, but not a compensatory system. It wouldn't have corrected distortions. And also, interestingly, it wouldn't really have dealt with that reapportionment issue that well. There wouldn't have been mandatory equal apportionment. There's one line of argument, which is that there were strong factions in the current coalition government that wanted to basically become the majority party and didn't really want to set up a really proportional system. Like, there are people who had broken off from the old Liberal Democrats who think that they can sort of work things so that they become the party that dominates things. It would have been a semi-proportional system. It would have been fairer than what we have, maybe similar to what they already have in some ways, though of course quite different in the way it was constructed. But anyway, I think that the fact that it all broke down, at least as of this point, it looks like it's not going to pass in the short term, could lead to, I think, a greater understanding of perhaps some of the things they could do to really get a fair system. There's different ones they could do, and you know, but I, it'll be interesting to see, because of course, the voting system has such an impact on what happens in an election that all the different sides are jockeying for how to control it, because in some ways controlling the reform might control the results.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with John Anderson and Rob Ritchie, both from the Center for Voting and Democracy. This is the second in a two-part series on democratic voting systems used around the world. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Please listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
Well, you mentioned limited voting in there, and that's one of those alternative voting systems that I see in your literature a lot, and I think you used another term for it, the single non-transferable system.
Right, meaning that you have a single vote, and it's non-transferable because there's another system that we're calling preference voting, in which there actually is this transferable quality. We've been talking about proportional systems that are party-less systems, ones in which you vote for a party and the party gets its fair share of seats.
You mean so far in our conversation, that's we've mostly focused on that party list, the mixed member, where you combine a representative from that represents a particular geographic constituency with someone who might come from a party list. Mm-hmm. That's what we've been discussing so far.
Right.
But your center sort of advocates or tries to explain a much broader spectrum of alternative voting systems, mm-hmm. and one of those is limited voting. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that one? You know, I know that most people understand when they go in to vote for their county supervisor, perhaps, or some sanitation district, there will often be five seats on it. You're presented with maybe seven candidates, and you get to vote five of them because there are five seats. Is that a limited voting system?
No, that's the tradition. That's a winner-take-all at-large system. That's actually, if you think about it, really not too different from a winner-take-all in a single-member district where you have one vote for one seat. If there's three seats and you have three votes and you cast on three different candidates, it's sort of similar mathematics. Any faction that's a majority will win all three seats. In the United States, there has been use of some alternatives to those systems. And the thing that's interesting about these systems is they don't rely on parties. So particularly for local government, I think that they would be the logical ones for local governments to consider. First is limited voting. That's probably the most simple to explain. And it's what they do in Japan and what they do in it's actually law for Pennsylvania county elections and for Connecticut city elections that you either limit the number of votes people have, so three seats, you only have one vote, or you limit the number of nominations a party can make. So that's what they do in Connecticut, for instance. You know, you can only nominate two-thirds of the seats that are open. So if it's a 9-member city council, you can only run 6. And that basically is a built-in way to get minority representation, minority defined as whatever people are in the minority based on whatever factor puts them there. That system is a semi-proportional system, and it has some merits, it has some flaws. There's another semi-proportional system that I'm sure John remembers from Illinois. It's called cumulative voting, and that was sort of put on the agenda in a big way last year by Lonnie Guinier, because she's quite interested in that as a way to enforce the Voting Rights Act. And maybe John can remember how it was used in the Illinois state legislature.
Well, for example, in my home district in northwest Illinois, that's the way we elected the state legislature. Well, of course, they did it throughout the state. There were three legislative representatives elected to go to Springfield, the state capital, and cumulative voting meant that the Democrats would nominate someone and get him on the ballot, and then the Democrats living within the boundaries of the district could cast all of the three votes for that one candidate. They could accumulate their votes as they do in electing corporate boards. Nothing very mysterious or strange about this. That's the way an awful lot of corporations elect their directors, and nobody complains. They think it's very fair. And for 100 years, we did this in the state of Illinois. It meant in my home district, to go back to that example for a moment, that the Democrats had a chance to elect somebody. It was such a heavily Republican area that unless they could cast all three votes for the one person that they had nominated and gotten on the ballot, they simply would be wiped out by the vast majority of Republican voters within that district. So it was a way of assuring representation. And I think you can make a very strong case today. And in Peoria, correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, I think in Peoria, Illinois, they still elect members of the city council on the basis of cumulative voting. Peoria just happens to be the hometown of the very conservative majority or minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives, Bob Michael. So there isn't anything very anti-democratic, I think, about the method that Peoria uses to elect its city council. So cumulative voting would be one system, and as Rob said, Lonnie Guinier felt that it would be a better way than to permit the present distortions that can occur through the winner-take-all system.
Another important form of proportional representation is preference voting. And I think that it is a very easy system for voters to use, a somewhat complicated system to describe, but it's a system that's like the single non-transferable vote, except it's called the single transferable vote, or preference voting. We call it preference voting because voters rank candidates in order of preference. And it's the system that's most likely to guarantee fair results. It's the system basically of choice for the English-speaking democracies that have adopted proportional representation. So Australia uses it for its Senate elections, Ireland uses it for its for national parliamentary elections, and actually it's a system that was used quite often in the United States at a city level earlier in this century, and Cambridge, Massachusetts uses it with good effect. And I think that that's one that, particularly when we're dealing with Voting Rights Act cases, we should take a good close look at.
Mr. Anderson, since you and Mr. Ritchie have both brought up the name of Lonnie Guinier, let's stop for a moment and talk about that. Certainly, she was vilified in the press, and the president withdrew his support for her for the position in the Justice Department, and the concepts of cumulative voting were stamped as quota systems, and she was called the quota queen. You disagree with that picture that was painted of her?
I certainly do, and actually I can with some pride say that I am one of the relatively few people in this country who has actually read the University of Virginia and the University of Pennsylvania Law Review articles that stirred up so much controversy. And actually, what she said in approving cumulative voting was that it was superior to race-conscious districting, the very thing that the Supreme Court struck down in that 1993 decision in Shaw v. Reno. So she wasn't proposing anything anti-democratic, and she was accused of that quite falsely. She was suggesting that there ought to be a fairer, more equitable way, and that this form of proportional representation, and that's what cumulative voting is, it's one of several different forms of proportional representation, would be one electoral system that would assure minority representation without creating these ridiculous districts that I spoke of earlier that are 160 miles long and the width of a highway corridor.
Yeah, I would just like to quote something that she writes for our Voting and Democracy Report 1993 that John mentioned. She writes in the report that a vision of fairness and justice must begin to imagine a full and effective voice for disadvantaged minorities, a voice that is accountable to self-identified community interest, and I'll just add self-identified, meaning that it's the voting preferences that count, a voice that persuades and a voice that is included in and resonates throughout the political process. That voice will not be achieved by majoritarian means or by enforced separation into winner-take-all racial districts. She is a someone who believes in the Voting Rights Act, which is actually the law of the land, and does require localities and states that have a history of racial oppression to permit members of racial and ethnic minorities to have a vote that helps elect someone. It doesn't have to be someone of their same race, just a voice that helps elect someone, a vote. And She, however, is critical of the main way that it's enforced, which is districts. And what was rather tragic last year is she was criticized for supporting that kind of approach. And actually, she's one of the leading voices for an alternative. And if we ever want to enforce the Voting Rights Act in a way that I think is not based on race, but on just based on fairness, you know, her approach is the way to go.
And what it is gerrymandering. Traditionally, people recoil in horror at the thought that we draw these districts on a gerrymandered basis. The court has struck down political gerrymandering. Now in Shaw v. Reno, they have said they don't like racial gerrymandering. The way to do it, and a very distinguished law professor, another law professor at the University of Michigan, Richard Pildes, put it this way, that the Voting Rights Act could be amended to encourage use of a practice known as cumulative voting. This practice would achieve the goals of the Act just as effectively while addressing the concerns of its detractors. So there's an essential fairness in what we are proposing. And I think the Supreme Court is beginning to speak to that issue. But what we would like to see is a better public understanding. PR, or proportional representation in the various forms that it can take, the mixed member form or the cumulative voting form or the single transferable vote form, all of that seems kind of complicated, and it takes a little time to thread through the argument with people to make them understand. But once they do, they will see that it is not anti-democratic, that it is far more democratic indeed than the system that we currently use. And that, as I said earlier, as you look at the international scene, the untold story of 1993 was the extent to which countries, newly emerging democracies, countries in Asia and in Europe, see the importance of constructing the kind of electoral system, the kind of voting system, that will give fair representation to all people.
That is John Anderson, former member of Congress and the 1980 candidate for President of the United States. He's now national chair of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Our other guest was Rob Ritchie, national director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette copy of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $9.95 per cassette plus $1.75 shipping and handling to Common Ground, show number 9407, Journal Graphics Incorporated, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. To order by credit card, please call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. However, to order cassettes or a printed transcript, please call Journal Graphics toll-free at 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.